Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and it is October 28th, 2013, Tuesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and you are listening to You Can't Score on Defense. This is Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul Channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. This book is available at Amazon.com on Kindle, and this priceless edition gives you the information to make you strong and give you life-saving information so you will not be a victim of murder by medicine. That is Amazon.com. Murder by medicine is no accident. And now back to our program. Of course, I always welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. And we are returning to the live format. So this is me live. And I'll take questions at the end. So today's topic, you can't score on defense. Healthcare is filled with opportunities to prevent disease, and these efforts at prevention are costly, time-consuming, and damage your health with side effects that are more likely and occur more often than the prevention they promise. This is like playing football and never having possession of the ball. And today, I'm going to talk about the harm these screening programs do, basically losing ground on defense, and natural ways to achieve more health, how you can get the ball and score and feel better without feeling worse. So first of all, what is defense? Well, defense is the act of defending what you have. And because people are kind of wired to be fear-based, to run away from things that are bad, to avoid horrible things, people will actually spend twice as much to protect what they have than they will spend to increase what they have. Another term for this is risk averse. In other words, people are more likely to spend money to keep from getting a serious illness than they will spend to get healthier. Now, this defensive tendency is being exploited by the medical industrial complex and Madison Avenue. And it's being used to make Americans sicker, poorer, and help them die sooner. My book, Murder by Medicine, details the research behind these numbers. These 861,000 deaths are due to the care received within 1 month of a person's death. So things like immunizations that cause childhood cancer are not counted in this number of murder by medicine. The aspirin a day that leads to kidney failure, which leads to dialysis, which leads to early death, is not counted in the murder by medicine statistics. So the actual problem is much greater than what is counted. So we're going to talk about preventing disease as opposed to enjoying and increasing your health. So when you prevent a disease, there's no benefit. In other words, you may be preventing something that would never have happened anyway. At the same time, you pay hard cash, which is insurance premiums, co-pays, deductibles, parking fees, and endure side effects, and endure extreme torture when you're falsely diagnosed, it's like being falsely accused, falsely diagnosed with disease and you undergo chemo or surgery or radiation that you don't need because you were actually healthy. And so preventing a condition only reduces your risk. It does not bring it to zero. This means that even if you do experience the disease you're trying to prevent, it does not mean the prevention failed. Perhaps you would have had the condition earlier or in a more severe form. At least this is what doctors and researchers try to get us to believe. So this is what we call a shell game. You can never know if you got what you paid for because it's a non-event. So what is defense? What does it mean in terms of, concrete action? So defense is a state of defending, like I said, against something. And in most sports, the team that's on defense cannot score. In other words, they can't rack up points and you can't win. And so you cannot win the game until you get off defense. And health is the same way. So let's talk about the screening tests, these defensive maneuvers, what they are, what they mean to you, and then we'll talk about offense, how to go from defense to offense and really take your health to the next level and make your life better. So screening tests are advised for a person who has no symptoms and basically no risk factors. This is defense. This person has no problems. Therefore, it's nothing to gain. Can only lose by playing the game. So what's wrong with defense? Well, the problem with defense is that screening tests do lie. While screening detects disease in the early stages, these cancers and even diseases, other diseases, often would never have progressed further, even without intervention. In other words, cancer screening often detects cancer that the immune system has already quarantined and neutralized, cancers that would have done no harm to the individual or interfered with his enjoyment of life. So a screening test aims to detect a disease or condition in the early stages and before it causes significant problems and where treatment can be offered. And that means where the doctor or the medical system can bill. That's what that means. Treatment can be offered means the system can profit. Bills can be made. So the potential benefits of a screening test should always outweigh any possible risk from the test. Well, we know better than this. This is just not really what happens. Now, a lot of people get screening tests because they want to answer the question, how healthy am I? Am I healthy? And I think this is fundamentally the problem. And this is the wrong question to ask. And even if it were the right question, this is a question only you have the answer to. It lies in you. So when you ask someone else if you're healthy, you're asking them to lie to you. They can only make it up because you're asking for voodoo, witchcraft, fortune-telling. People who would not engage in gambling, who would never engage in witchcraft or fortune-telling, willingly engage in asking if they will get sick. What are the chances? You even got the gambling vocabulary here of illness and how long will they live? And the doctor's answers are actually taken seriously. When, of course, this is really nothing more than entering a grand casino where the odds have already been stacked against you. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. This book is available on Amazon Kindle. This priceless edition gives you the information to make you strong and give you life-saving information so you will not be a victim of Murder by Medicine. That's Amazon.com, and Murder by Medicine is No Accident. Of course, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Now back to our program. So what are some examples of medical defense? First of all, cholesterol drugs. This is a biggie. Cholesterol-lowering drugs, for example, Baycol, a biggie, pulled from the market just 2 months ago because it caused 31 documented deaths. In other words, we're not talking about the undocumented deaths. The documented deaths are 31 for a condition that's not deadly. Now, other cholesterol drugs that are still on the market only cause lupus-like syndrome, pancreatitis, arthritis, and rashes. This is clearly a defensive move, accepting a loss of health today with the hope of prevention in the future. This is definitely a losing gamble because the loss is absolutely assured and the benefit The cholesterol manufacturers themselves state that it takes 1,250 patient years of use before one person benefits from cholesterol medications, but it only takes 3 patient years of use before one patient experiences harm. So that's a pretty high harm-to-benefit ratio. Now, next, what we can take a look at. Well, one aspirin a day. This is my favorite. People are advised to take one baby aspirin. That's 81 milligrams. Many people, erroneously, feel this is a minuscule, therefore same, harmless and safe dose. It's simply not the case. So let's look at the math on this one. And by the way, this is very timely because there's actually a study published October 28, 2013. Yes, that's yesterday. Hot off the presses from the National Institute of Health Research. That's in the UK. That's their corresponding NIH. In other words, these are government numbers, right? Government numbers. They have a national health program over there. They're definitely in favor of these drugs. And so this is what the pro-drug institution says. It says one aspirin a day is designed to prevent heart attack and stroke. And what they found is that there are 46 fewer deaths per 100,000 users per year, and there are 86 fewer heart attacks per 100,000 users per year. So every year, 132 people per 100,000 users benefits from the use of aspirin because a heart attack, 46 deaths were prevented and 86 fewer heart attacks were had. Sounds good. Well, let's look at the harm. Same study, 178 non-trivial bleeds. So basically a person swallowed the aspirin, it thinned their blood so much that they bled. And it bled so much it could not be considered trivial. So 178. Already we've exceeded the benefit. Next, 49 major bleeds. As a medical doctor, I can tell you a major bleed is a bleed that required a transfusion or medical intervention. 49 major bleeds. And then 117 more gastrointestinal bleeds. And, of course, 10 hemorrhagic strokes. You tell me, would you rather a stroke or a heart attack? So what is that? 354 people harmed and 132 benefited. So every year that you take an aspirin a day, you're 2.6 times as likely to be harmed by the aspirin as helped each year of use. Now, this is just a study, which doesn't really tell you the actual man-in-the-street experience. So let me give you a man-in-the-street experience. A patient takes one aspirin a day. And I've seen this happen. And don't they get indigestion? What does the doctor say? Well, you need the little purple pill, which is what? It's an H2 blocker. The person takes the H2 blocker, they feel a little bit better. But if it's a man or a woman, they might get a little depressed. And the doctor says, oh, no problem. We can just give you an SSRI, the most modern antidepressant. As a result of the antidepressant, the person gets, if it's a man, sexual dysfunction. In other words, he can no longer have sex. Now he needs the little blue pill to go with his little purple pill. And so now you've taken a perfectly healthy person who is doing absolutely fine, thank you, and you have them on 4 drugs, all of which have death associated with them as a possible side effect. So, this is one piece of defensive maneuver that is very, very damaging to the individual embarking on it. Next. Well, let's take a look at prostate cancer. Now, a lot of guys are being told to get screened for prostate cancer. Sounds good. Until, let's look at the most, well, first of all, if you look at this, a plain old study of prostate cancer. This is where you go on the internet, find cancer studies, what do you find? This is a United States study, by the way. They found that the 5-year survival for people who were treated for prostate cancer was 100%. That sounds fabulous. Like, whoa, definitely, I want to know if I have prostate cancer so I can have it 100% 5-year survival, right? Well, guess what the 5-year survival is for people who are not treated for their prostate cancer? 5 years survival is 100%. So you have 100% survival whether you take the mutilating, emasculating therapy or whether you don't. So why get screened? What's the point in detecting the cancer if it's not even deadly? By the way, the word cancer applies to a group of diseases, and these group of diseases are considered cured if a person survives 5 years. That's it. That's all there is to it. So if you are diagnosed with prostate cancer, you have a 100% cure rate without therapy. Now, at the 5-year point, even if the person's body is riddled with cancer, they are defined as cured because they lived 5 years. Just a bookkeeping formality, but that's the way it is. Okay, so that's one study. Here's another study. This is by the United States Prevention Screening Task Force. All right, another government agency. So autopsy studies have shown that roughly 1 in 3 men over age 50 has prostate cancer. Clearly, obviously, many, read most, of these prostate cancers would never cause a problem or never be discovered without screening. But if a cancer is detected through a PSA test and follow-up biopsy, it's not easy to tell how dangerous it is. And the momentum carries most patients into aggressive therapy like surgery, radiation, hormone therapy, whose side effects are impotence and incontinence. That means peeing in your pants. So this is something to consider. This is such a damaging thing that this organization, this government task force, has actually come out and recommended no PSA screenings, no prostate cancer screening whatever for men who are 75 years of age or older. And so there's no benefit. But even if you're of whatever age, the prostate cancer benefit is not great. Now, in Europe, they did a study, and they found there's 20% reduction in prostate cancer death among men screened for the disease. Now, before you get too excited, the biggest death I've seen in a U.S. study is a 5% death over a 5-year period, which is not any higher than the baseline death rate of 0.8% per year. So in other words, if you live in the United States, your chances of dying any 1 year is 0.8%. So 0.8 times 5 is 4%. So the death rate from prostate cancer is 5%. So really only 1% of that death could be attributed to prostate cancer. All right. So we got 20% reduction in prostate cancer death. So we don't know what the percentage that they're reducing, but I assure you it's minuscule. However, what they found was there was a very high price for this. For every life saved in the decade after screening, so now expanding it to 10 years, the investigators concluded 48 men were subjected to needless treatment for prostate cancers that would not have harmed them. This is mind-boggling. So you have to take 48 men, make them impotent, make them piss their pants, in order to extend the life of one person. Remember, they use the term lives saved, but the truth of the matter is, nobody's getting out of this alive. I mean, we're all going to die. So a life saved is not a life saved. It's a life extended. We don't know if it's extended by days or weeks or months. And so, again, this cancer is so harmless that they even use a 10-year window instead of the usual 5-year window. So that's very very interesting. Station identification here. You are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at blakeradio.com. Please visit our sponsor, which is Murder by Medicine is No Accident. And this book is available on Amazon Kindle for a phenomenally low price of $3, by the way. This extremely valuable edition gives you the information you need to make you strong and give you life-saving resolve so you will not be a victim of murder by medicine. And that's at Amazon.com. Murder by Medicine is No Accident. Okay, now back to our program. Well, what would PSA prostate screening be without mammograms? Now, mammograms are very interesting. Mammograms are recommended between depends on who you look at, age 50 to 74. This is by the feds, the United States Task Force on Cancer Screening. So they've changed their guidelines. It used to be starting at age 40 every other year, but now it's only between the ages of 50 and 74. There's no known benefit or harm, they say, after age 74. So now the American Cancer Society wants mammograms annually, that's every year, starting at age 40, to as long as woman is in good health, which means as long as she can pass a preoperative physical exam to qualify her for her mastectomy surgery. That's my interpretation. So as life expectancy diminishes, the harms outweigh the benefits of early detection and treatment of cancers that may be slow growing. And even in youth, if you have a young person, 40 years old, for example, with a slow growing breast cancer that would never have killed them, say, before the age of 95, what is the value of discovering that cancer and cutting off the woman's breast and subjecting her to radiation and chemo, which may actually shorten her life? So the mammogram thing is a real issue. There's a landmark study in the United States that was done on mammogram screening. And what this study revealed was that if you go for a mammogram screening, it means you're feeling fine, everything's okay, mammogram screening, then 10 of every 11 cancers diagnosed by mammogram and biopsy, so they actually took a sample, looked under the microscope, 10 of 11 are false positives. In other words, they're detecting conditions that would never have caused this woman a problem in her lifetime. So that is a lot of harm. And in those cases, then, with mammogram screening, the death rate that occurs after mammogram screening is due to the therapy, the intervention, not the cancers themselves. So it's really a problem. Now, what else are we talking about here? Let's take a look at pap smears. Pap smears are very interesting. Pap smears are done on millions and millions of women every year. And the theory behind the pap smear is that there's this virus called the human papilloma wart virus that causes cervical cancers. And by detecting this virus, which causes characteristic changes in the cells of the cervix, and doing surgery to remove or shave off or freeze the skin of the cervix, that cervical cancer is being prevented. Sounds good. Problem is that there are many strains of human papilloma wart virus, hundreds actually, and only 8 are associated with cancer. And you can't tell which strain you have. In fact, as a doctor who's practiced for 10 years and done pap smears for 10 years, first of all, I did not detect a single case of cervical cancer, not one, in 10 years of pap smears, doing pap smears on people. Second, the frequency of deaths in the United States from cervical cancer in unscreened populations is 6 deaths per 100,000. Once you screen these women for cervical cancer, the death rate falls to 3 per 100,000. So first of all, it's a very rare disease, not very frequently found. Number two, the benefit at most is 3 people per 100,000. To put this in perspective, the benefit of a pap smear is not even as great as the benefit of 1 aspirin a day. And that's a pretty poor benefit. And again, you throw into that the false positives with women who are getting unnecessary surgeries because of the false positives, then there's actually a fair amount of harm from the pap smears and the intervention. So that's pap smears. Then there's vaccines. Now, vaccines are the ultimate in a defensive maneuver. No matter what vaccine you're getting the vaccine for something that you don't have. So you're getting a vaccine for a disease that you do not have. And in certain cases in the United States, for example, polio, the vaccine effectiveness has to be 0%. Why? Because there is no case of vaccine in the United States separate from the vaccine. So the only way to get polio in the United States is to get vaccinated. You would think that might be a reason to stop administering the polio vaccine. But no, it apparently is not. But as a knowledgeable citizen, there might be reason for you to stop taking the polio vaccine. There's a list of all other vaccines, but I will say this about the vaccines. There's just no evidence that they're effective. That's number one. Number two, they're obviously harmful. You know, it's very ordinary routine for people who get vaccines to get swelling, pain, fever, or tenderness. And that's if they're lucky. A lot of people progress on to get things like seizures, leukemia, and permanent disability, even death. So that's enough said about vaccines. I think certainly if you're an adult capable to refuse on your own behalf, you should do so. If you have a job that requires vaccines, I think you should consider other employment. For myself, as a physician, I was often asked to get vaccines, and that's one reason why I had my own private practice, is I did not want to be coerced into taking any vaccine I didn't want to take. Next is prophylactic antibiotics. Again, taking antibiotics to prevent something, taking it for a condition you do not have. Antibiotics is a class of drugs in the United States are responsible for 99,000 deaths a year. That's a lot of deaths. How? Why? Because taking antibiotics creates resistant bacteria. And these resistant bacteria then cause deaths. So these are just the documented deaths. There are so many undocumented deaths. For example, many antibiotics cause suicide. Take the antibiotic, just like you're told, for 1 week. And during the course while you're taking it, or 3 to 6 weeks later, you commit suicide. Why? Oh, because all of a sudden you think it's a good idea. Why? Because of the influence, because of the effect of the antibiotic. So antibiotics are definitely deadly. And so you have to really think twice before taking an antibiotic for a condition that's not deadly. When I say not deadly, I mean not immediately deadly. And I refer you to vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files. And if you enter your name and email address, you will get a report that will list for you all the things you can do at home to treat infections and not need antibiotics. And these are the same things I use in my medical practice that made it so I just didn't need to write antibiotic prescriptions anymore. Why would I even think of developing such a list? Was I so brilliant that I realized antibiotic resistance was killing people? No, actually not. I'd like to claim that, but that's not the case. I just noticed patients weren't getting better with antibiotics. I just noticed that when I prescribed an antibiotic, I just did a whole bunch of other work. People would get side effects. They'd call me up at 2 a.m. to say they thought they felt like they were about to die, and I'd have to, first of all, they woke me up at 2 a.m., and then I'd have to stop the antibiotic, and da-da-da-da. I said, you know what? Let's not even get started. And so, because I found that I would use antibiotics either for ear infections or for sinus infections, constantly seeing people back, and they just weren't getting better. I said, you know what? Let me do something else. So, get that report. It'll save you from one of the deadliest drugs out there. Then we talked about cholesterol therapy. Hypertension therapy, this is a hoot. First of all, if you have high blood pressure, you obviously have high blood pressure, but why are you treating high blood pressure? Well, you're treating your high blood pressure because you have been led to believe that if you treat your high blood pressure, it will prevent heart attack, stroke, and kidney failure. That's what you've been told. Sounds good. Until you take a look at the studies on hypertensive medications and their effectiveness. Turns out that if you take your blood pressure medicine just as prescribed by your doctor perfectly, don't miss a dose, don't do that. You take it perfectly, it will take about 480 years for you to experience the benefit of the avoided heart attack or the avoided stroke. Now, since your average person is not going to live more than, say, 150 years, this is really an empty promise. We're going to save your life in 100 years from now. That's 480 years from now. That doesn't really cut it. You know what I mean? So, hypertensive therapy, not necessarily beneficial. Do people with hypertension die sooner than people without hypertension? Absolutely. Does the hypertensive medication close that gap? Does it give that hypertensive person the lifespan of a Non-hypertensive person? Absolutely not. I was absolutely crushed, when I had really studied hard to master all these blood pressure medications and exactly how to administer them. Then I went to a continuing medical education conference, and they announced that we are not saving one single life, not one life, by treating hypertension. I said, well, why should just go back to my medical practice and take everybody off their medicines, off their blood pressure medicine? No, don't do that. We have to keep doing what we're doing because it's the standard of care, and new, better things are going to come along in the future, and we will have more effective medications. Okay. Well, that was back in 1985. Yes, 1985. It's now 2013, and guess what? We're still prescribing blood pressure medications, and they are still ineffective. So there we have it. Then we have diabetes therapy. Now, if you have diabetes, your blood pressure is up. Of course your blood pressure is elevated. But why are you treating it? Why are you treating it with drugs? Well, you're treating it with drugs because you don't want to have a stroke. You don't want to have a heart attack. Right? That's what you're told. So with diabetes, diabetes, what happens? Also, you don't want to go into a coma. Oh, yes. People have told me, oh, doctor, I don't want to go into a coma. Oh, no. So you take your therapy. And what do we know about therapy? First of all, we know that often diabetics receive an excessive dose of their medicines, which puts them into a coma. Yes, right. Blood pressure too low puts you into a coma as well. And this happens with amazing regularity, much more frequently, by the way, than blood sugar going too high and putting a person in a coma. Next thing, the medicines used to treat diabetes cause heart attack and cause stroke. So what else do we know about this? Well, if you do everything just like your doctor tells you to do, with your diabetes therapy, it will take about 712 years of use for you to experience a life-extending event. In other words, for you to actually miss a heart attack or a stroke. Now, again, because most people are not going to be alive for 714 years, this is another empty promise. An empty promise. Then, of course, we have prenatal care. Prenatal care has been absolutely, without a doubt, proven not to positively impact the outcome for the baby. And it has profoundly worsened the outcome for the mother because of so many invasive maneuvers. Why does it not adversely affect the outcome for the baby? Because fetal deaths before 20 weeks, and all these procedures are done before 20 weeks, some at 7 weeks, some at 14, some at 16, all these procedures that decrease the life expectancy for the mother, basically murder her. Maternal mortality has increased fivefold in the United States in the past 25 years, attributable to prenatal care. So babies that die or pregnancies that end in that 0 to 20-week period are not counted in the infant mortality statistics. So the intervention that shortens the baby's life is not counted. So prenatal care is another act, another defensive act. You're defending what you already have, because what do you have? You've got a pregnancy inside of you. It's a defensive maneuver. You're trying to extend the pregnancy. You're trying to maybe improve the pregnancy. So it's a defensive maneuver. And so what happens then is you end up losing what you have, which is your life and the life of your baby. So hazards. I mentioned a few hazards, but Harvard Medical School weighs in on this. This is very shocking. And this was published on October 20th in the Journal of American Medical Association, 2013. So this is just a couple weeks ago. And so Harvard Medical School says it's the doctor's fault. So the majority of people are not informed by their doctor that cancer tests may detect cancers. But such tests can also cause harm through overdiagnosis and overtreatment. That means slapping the cancer label on healthy people. And so early warning cancer tests may detect slow-growing or no-growing cancers that will never cause symptoms or affect health. And so undergoing surgery, chemotherapy, or radiation for such cancers provides no benefits and definite harm. Unfortunately, doctors and pathologists do not know how to tell the slow-growing, no-growing cancers from the ones are aggressively growing. And so there's a study that showed barely one-third of U.S. doctors were able to provide correct estimates for the extent of overdiagnosis for mammograms, breast cancer, and PSA testing, prostate cancer. Now, the reason for this is doctors who go to continuing medical education classes are not given these statistics. This is not shared. It's not discussed in medical school. It's not discussed in continuing medical education. And even worse, these screening tests are built into the standard of care, which the doctor is not free to deviate from. And we have this phenomenon coming up in the United States, which is the Affordable Care Act, which means that now the government is supervising the doctors and saying to the doctors, you must conform to the standard of care. So this is a lot more pressure for doctors to order these tests that are doing a tremendous amount of harm. Now, when I was in medical practice, patients would come in and say, oh, doc, I want this screening test or that screening test. And I try to tell them, well, this result may not be reliable, this test might not be reliable, but they heard on TV and this and that, and they were just absolutely insistent. And it was like they were in a trance and couldn't stop to listen or even stop themselves from submitting to this torture and mutilation. So it was very, very shocking. So what's a person to do? What can you do? Well, I went to a cocktail party last week. I'm here in Panama, and every now and then the gringos get together, they have a party. So I went to the party, I met this guy, he was 97 years old. I have to say, he looked every day of 97. Not a young 97. I mean, he got around, he walked very well, he's really in good spirits, a cheerful guy. And so I asked him how he got to be 97. He smiled and said, I stayed away from doctors. I had to laugh at that. So what do? The answer is, and this takes a lot of balls, sometimes it takes courage to live, do not do screening of any kind. This saves you the appointment, the humiliation, the humiliating groping exams of the hands of the doctor during the exam, painful blood draw, damaging radiation of tests that may be ordered, and the stressful wait for results. Finally, you're spared the false positives and the torture of mutilating and possibly murderous therapy that would follow. So this is important. Stand down. Do not submit to screening of any kind. Period. Done. End of discussion. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniel on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. So what are you going to do? Well, get off the defense and get on the offense. That's right. Get that ball and score. So what does it mean to score? Well, let's just say you're a guy. If you're a guy, scoring means regaining your sexual function without increasing your heart attack risks. In other words, getting back in the saddle, so to speak, without the little blue pill. Scoring means reducing your heart attack risk without increasing your stroke risk, like so many cholesterol drugs do. And scoring means improving your diabetes without increasing your heart attack risk. It means thinning your blood without bleeding to death. So offense means playing to win. It means engaging in activities that will allow you to have a happy, joyful life filled with your favorite activities without worry. That sounds like a big promise, doesn't it? So, I first have to tell you what the recommendations are by the establishment. Then I'll tell you my recommendations. Now, what does Harvard Medical School recommend for an offensive plan? So, Harvard Medical School says this is what you do before you even get sick. They say maintain a healthy weight. That's it. Maintain a healthy weight. They don't even tell you what a healthy weight is. Well, I'm here to tell you that the weight that doctors tell you to maintain, according to height weight charts, or even those incredible flat tummies they advertise on the Internet, in our toxic world, heavier people in the United States are actually living longer. The fat appears to be protective against the toxins and chemicals in the environment. That weight in the weight charts may not be as healthy as we once thought. So maintain a healthy weight is pretty much useless advice because right now, medically speaking, we don't know what a healthy weight is. Your doctor doesn't know what a healthy weight is. So what's the next thing? Do not smoke or use other tobacco products. This is interesting, and on the face of it, sounds like good advice. However, it's been my observation that people who use organic tobacco and roll their own do not have the ill effects of cigarettes. This is absolutely shocking because as a physician, I'm just so used to, my way or the highway. That's what we're taught, that we tell people do this or else. And with cigarettes, it appears that the chemicals added to the tobacco and the paper by the manufacturer appears to be what's responsible for the ill effects of cigarettes. Next, either avoid alcohol or drink an average of no more than one alcoholic beverage per day. An average, that means, what, you get smashed on weekends with 7 drinks a day. Just by the way, the recommended alcohol intake in 1981, I was in medical school, I was there, sitting in a seat, paying attention. The recommended was 4 drinks a day. If you could stay under 4 drinks a day, why, by golly, you were just fine. Now, the other thing to take a look at is even one drink a day increases breast cancer risk tremendously, breast cancer and heart attack risk. So I don't know where this alcohol recommendation comes from. So now we do know that absolute abstinence from alcohol does not confer health benefits compared to an occasional drink. And we don't even know, doctors don't know, what that magic number is. So if you take teetotalers and you take people who are light drinkers, I guess that would be less than seven drinks a week. The people who drink less than 7 drinks a week, we'll call it 6, live longer. So if living longer is your goal, abstinence does not appear to contribute to that. Having said that, I personally don't drink. Avoid binge drinking even if the average amount of alcohol you drink is moderate. Okay, so what they're saying is, to contradict what they said before, which is, before they said you can have an average of 7 drinks a week, and here they're saying, no, even if the average is okay, you can't drink a lot in one time and then the other, so it's not an average. I guess what they're saying then is 1 drink a day. Okay, but again, it's not clear. So if it's not clear, then you don't know what to do, and it's not helpful advice. All right, next they say eat a diet rich in vegetables, especially the green leafy ones. They are rich in folic acid. And for women, folic acid may offset any increased risk of breast cancer if you drink alcohol. That's interesting. So we know that breast cancer is definitely increased by drinking alcohol. And actually, they don't tell you here, is that the desire to drink is a reflection of folic acid / B vitamin deficiency. So you can just, if you feel like drinking, just take B vitamins with your alcohol. That's what I'd recommend. Next, they say increase your fiber intake. It may lower your risk of colon cancer. In other words, it may not. So, again, more vagueness. It appears we're not really sure about this one. There are many types of fiber, by the way, soluble, insoluble, fresh fiber, dehydrated fiber. If you have a dehydrator, you may be making dehydrated dishes. That's a whole other type of fiber. So not all fiber is useful or helpful fiber. Next, stay physically active and try to find time every day for dedicated exercise. Aim for at least 150 minutes of exercise per week. Again, really too vague to be helpful. There are certain types of exercise that are actually damaging. One would be jogging. Why? I make a lot of enemies with this one, but I have to tell you the truth, right? It turns out that something like jogging and your basic aerobic exercises deplete B vitamins. So how do you take care of this? Just take a B vitamin supplement or increase the B vitamins in your diet. No, stop that pasta loading because that's what leads to everything. The pasta depletes B vitamins. So if you want to stay, the way to stay physically active is to physically do things. In other words, walk up and down the stairs or physical activity. Going to the gym and working out, I'm not really sure how that stacks up in terms of disease prevention or extending a person's life. Okay. So why should you be suspicious of this plan? You should be very suspicious because the plan may not work for you. I mean, I'll be honest, it hasn't really worked for anyone else. I mean, this is advice that people get. You've got the food pyramid. People follow these things and get sicker and sicker every day. So that doesn't really work. So what else? Let's try another approach. What's your condition when you're considering prevention? Your condition is, one, that you're alive, and two, you don't have the disease. So set your goals differently. Instead of working on a number of blood pressure, cholesterol, whatever, aim for quality of life. Aim for happiness. You can take the short view. Why? Why endure unhappiness and get bad and unreliable news? Doesn't make sense. Why go to a doctor to get a test to find out or to be told you have a disease that you really don't have. So this is that's a serious dead end. So this is what I recommend. I recommend you list all the things you want to do with your life, whatever they are. And if to ask yourself, will having an annual exam facilitate this goal? For example, let's say you want to get health life insurance. Maybe you need to get an exam for life insurance. All right, fine. Get the exam, but don't take any of the results seriously. Realize you're getting an exam to get the life insurance. You're not getting an exam to find out what these test results are. That's irrelevant. It's not what you're doing. Okay. For example, some people have a goal of living long enough to see their grandkids. So the answer is, will being sodomized with a colonoscopy help you reach this goal? Probably not. So if your health permits you to do all the things in your list and you feel fine, then everything is fine. Leave it alone. That's it. If your health does not allow you to do what you want, then you have to ask yourself, what do you need to change in order to get what you want? Let's say, for example, you have difficulty going upstairs. Maybe you can handle that by practicing. Maybe. Maybe you can handle that by improving your diet. So chances are you do not need a colonoscopy to reach your life goals. Let's talk about herbal equivalents. So what herbs are equivalent to the whole preventative routine or game that's being presented as the only game in town here? So those of you who want to play the prevention game anyway, so here are some herbal equivalents that will not kill you. All right. Aspirin a day to thin blood. Skip the aspirin, increase your water intake. Convert your beverages to water. The real reason your blood is thick is lack of water. So instead of the aspirin, take a glass of water. The other thing, if you're trying to prevent a heart attack, a reason for a heart attack is, again, B vitamin deficiency, so take your B-complex 50, 2 a day. Next, cholesterol. This is a hoax. Don't worry about it. Your body needs cholesterol for repairs. Just reduce your wheat and your wheat flour products and sugar. These things damage your blood vessels and damage your body parts and require cholesterol for repairs. So if you stop eating wheat flour products and sugar, you'll need fewer repairs and your cholesterol will go down. Next is breast cancer. Those of you who are listening, if you have kids and grandkids, have your first child before age 20. This cuts breast cancer risk in half. Yep, that's it. Cuts breast cancer risk in half. There is no better prevention to have that first kid before 20. Next, do not smoke cigarettes or drink alcohol. And eat your broccoli. That's about the size of it for breast cancer prevention. Now, obviously, don't take drugs because it appears birth control pills make it worse and just drugs of any kind. So if you just leave drugs alone, by drugs I mean prescription drugs, then you'll be just fine. Colonoscopy. Okay. For this, just take Vitality capsules and poop regular. They'll keep your colon clean and those cancer-causing chemicals will not hang around long enough to bother you. And that's at vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files. And you should have a little box upper right corner there. Fill that in. Oh, I'm sorry. Just click on the bottle, and then it'll show you how to buy it. Next, pap smear. Definitely skip this one. The yield is very low. And you can take B-complex 52 a day. Pap smear, lately, the latest word on that is it's a B vitamin deficiency. So that's the defense plan. So what's the natural offense plan? So you guys get those questions ready. We're going to be ready for those in a few minutes. So what would I recommend you do? Focus on measurable, positive outcome goals. Have a parasite eradication program. This is very, very important. You deworm your pets, you should do the same for yourself. This is very important. My personal recommendation is turpentine. It's a candida cleaner. And you'll be finding out more about that in a couple of weeks. But parasite eradication program. Some people like to eat raw garlic. You have to have a parasite eradication program just because people encounter parasites throughout their lives and they tend to hang around. So you need to take a pause every now and then and ask them to leave. Next, eat the cleanest food available. I would say wild harvested or organic raised without hormones on a natural diet. So if you're going to eat meat, eat hormone-free meat and antibiotic-free meat. That's very important. and the animal ate whatever its natural diet is. Next, make a list of what you enjoy doing and plan to do more of it. Improve your health only to the point necessary to enjoy your favorite things, whatever they are. And never seek to gain a result that cannot be measured. Example, lowering your heart attack. There's no way to determine if your heart attack risk is lowered. It's just not possible. One question to ask your doctor if you find yourself talking to a doctor. Ask, is your condition deadly? If your doctor tells you the condition is not deadly, do not accept deadly medication. So, but if it is deadly, the doctor says, yes, it's deadly. Ask how much longer you have to live without therapy. If a doctor tells you that you may live 1 month without therapy, chances are good that there's a natural solution out there, and 1 month is plenty of time to find it. The other thing is that the doctor tells you that your condition is not deadly, then you have to ask him about the medicine he's offering. Ask him, is the medication deadly? In other words, has anyone ever died taking that medication at that dose that he is recommending? And if he tells you yes, then you definitely just ask him to pick something else where the dose he's prescribing is not equal to the minimum lethal dose. The other thing is, even if the doctor tells you he's not aware of anyone who's died at that dose, like any doctor will tell you, an aspirin a day, of course nobody dies of that. Check it out. Go ask Dr. Google. Get a second opinion. Ask Dr. Google. So Google your medication and Google deaths from and fill in the name of your medication, and you'll see if death is an expected side effect. Now, the next thing you need to do, so there's no benefit in prevention from a medicinal x-ray biopsy point of view because there's too many false positives. And we talked about natural prevention. We have a question here, so we're going to take this question, then I'm going to talk some more about natural interventions. Okay, here we are. Let's see. I'm going to click this button, and I'm going to guess that something's going to happen. Okay, you're on the air.
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes, I do.
I have a question. When you mm-hmm. were recapping, what is the best thing without having to take the prescription drug to lower blood pressure? I'm not fat. I'm 100 pounds. I'm 5'1½", yet I have high blood pressure.
Okay. All right. We will talk about that. Okay. So if you have high blood pressure, then your doctor's got you taking drugs, let's say, to lower these blood pressures. The first thing for blood pressure is to increase your hydration. So calculate, say, 100 pounds, then that means you should be drinking between 1 and 2 quarts of water a day. I would push it up higher to 2 quarts of water. The next thing to do is to add a little salt to the water, the second quart of water. Add about a teaspoon of salt to it. So now you've got water going on. The next thing to do, especially skinny people who have high blood pressure, a lot of times they're constipated, and so you've got to have bowel movements. You can get Vitality Capsules for that, which is available on my site, or you can use psyllium husk. Now, psyllium is really amazing because you can just use psyllium as a thickener in your gravies or sauces or whatever, and it will clean you out and increase the number of bowel movements. And that's nice and smooth. And I would recommend buying pure psyllium husk because the Metamucil, which is psyllium husk, made by drug companies, is filled with a lot of chemicals, additives, and things that will actually make you very sick, so don't do that. That's a basic start, and then you can go, if that doesn't do it, you can go the next step further, which is hawthorn, milk thistle, and cayenne. So that's a whole, you know, you just have to go as far as you need to go to solve the problem. If you're taking just one drug, chances are good that you can just do, increase your water, poop more, take milk thistle, and you're done. So everybody is different. But hypertension is basically a combination of two things, actually three things, dehydration, toxins or chemicals that are lining your blood vessels, making them narrower, and B vitamin deficiency, which causes your blood vessels to contract a bit, which is more than what they should do. Okay, we have a second question here. Hi, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, do you have a question?
Hi, Dr. Daniels. I have a question regarding the protocol on the report, which my significant other and I are both doing together. And there's been a lot, I've had a lot of depression lifelong that comes and goes in varying degrees. What else can we do besides the five-step protocol?
Depression is a case of toxicity. That is what I found, just the number one. The most important thing you can do for depression is to take either charcoal or clay or a combination of the two, in addition to having more bowel movements and drinking more water. And once the chemicals are soaked up, the depression just clears in a blink, and you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe it's gone so quick. But that's what the problem is. The problem is toxicity.
Okay. Well, I'm doing the castor oil, and I have clay here, or I actually have clay and charcoal. So I started at a teaspoon a day. Would you suggest more than that or just kind of hold right there?
The amount is irrelevant. What you're looking for is bowel movements, something close to diarrhea, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a whatever it takes thing.
Okay. That's where I've been working on that. And then I have a question about hormones. Will that also balance out by itself when the gut gets clear of toxins?
Well, what you're really trying to clear is not the gut. You're actually trying to clear the liver.
Because
it's the liver's job to clear the blood, and your blood is obviously not clear because these chemicals are circulating to your brain and telling you that you're depressed when there's probably nothing wrong. I mean, I had this patient who came in to see me, and she said, you know, I've got the best husband in the world. I live in the best house in the world. I've got the greatest children in the world. We have all the money we could need or even spend, and I'm depressed. And so I said to her, well, you must be on drugs. And sure enough, her problem actually was her blood pressure medication. When I switched it, her depression cleared up immediately. Now, that's an example where a known chemical is identified and removed. In your case, you might have chemicals really all over the place. It could be your beauty products, your foundation, your moisturizer, your deodorant. It could be something that you're putting in your mouth or on your skin. I don't know if maybe you might have hair that gets dyed or tinted, but you really have to take a broader view of where these chemicals are coming from, especially if you've had depression for several years. If you've had depression for several years, because your body naturally detoxes and gets rid of chemicals on a regular kind of rolling basis, then you've got to consider there's something you're doing again and again and again that's putting chemicals back in, even though your immune system's working very hard to get rid of them. So that's what you need to take a look at. You need to really aggressively and dispassionately take a look at what chemicals you might be putting in your body. And for help with that, you can go to my website, vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files, and click on the Discovery Session tab and fill that out, and we can explore the possibility of working together and helping you identify those chemicals and fixing things. Now, you know, we usually have next week's topic all set and ready to go, but actually we don't, so I'll be sending out emails to let you know about next week's topic. But this week, one example I have is you just have to aggressively not use drugs. For example, using aloe leaves for severe burns instead of narcotics, or using cayenne pepper and vinegar for a heart attack instead of angioplasty. But you just have to, at all times, substitute non-deadly therapies for deadly therapies. And when you talk to a doctor, if you find yourself in a hospital or emergency room, let them know that you want something that's less than the minimum lethal dose. And most doctors, if they know their drugs, they'll know that the recommended standard of care dosage is much higher than the minimum lethal dose. But we are told in medical school that it's worth it to the patient to drop dead or risk death. And what I'm suggesting is that you not under any circumstances accept that risk, that you bring it out in the open, discuss it, and refuse it. So That's it, and this is the conclusion of Healing with Dr. Daniels.